Chapter 24. I wiped the sleep from my eyes and licked my teeth with my tongue. A yawn tickled the inside of my nose and began crawling down my throat. I tried to fight it off, but in the end my body relented to the yawn, invoking muscles I had no control over to flex. It felt like someone had a crowbar wedged between my third and fourth ribs and was trying to pry them apart, a pain just a notch below the one emanating from my left lung. You know that guy from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom who gets his heart ripped out, then gets lowered into the lava pit? Well, he could maybe relate to what I was going through. I mention this because the only movies my father owned were the Indiana Jones collection, and I had watched each movie 3 times in the last 5 days. I'm still a tad puzzled by the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, did Spielberg sleep with the special effects guy's wife or something? Seriously. Anyhow, I lolled my head to the left and peered at the glass coffee table. It was littered with peanut butter and jelly debris, a half-finished bag of Oreos, and a barrage of juice boxes. Talk about deja vu. For a split second, I was back in Maine. It was Thanksgiving morning, and I had just woken up from a horrible nightmare. I pondered sitting up, but the thought was fleeting. I'm not sure if it was the fact I hadn't seen the sun for over 3 weeks, or if I was in withdrawal from the Vicodin, or if it was because I hadn't been able to exercise in over a week, or because I hadn't talked to Lacey in the past couple days, or if it was Ellen Gray's death, or Adam Gray's guilt, or my incompetence, or if I was falling in love again, or if I had some residual feelings for Alex, or a combination of all of these, but I was having a slight bout of depression, and by slight, I mean severe, and by depression, I mean wanting to jump off the Space Needle. But that would involve getting off the couch, so I was at a bit of a crossroads. Maybe I needed one of those seasonal depression lamps. I pushed myself off the couch, made my way to the VCR, popped out Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and slipped into Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. On a side note, after much deliberation, I decided that I needed to buy a whip. Just saying. I was halfway through the movie. The part where Sean Connery scares all the birds with his umbrella and they fly into the plane's propeller, when it happened. I'd made a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and decided to throw a couple Oreos in the mix. It wasn't half bad, but I did get overly aggressive with the jelly and a huge blob of it leaked out the top of my PBJ&O and landed between my legs on the sofa. Just when you think you've hit rock bottom. I cleaned it up using the powerful spray of a juice box, sort of a lazy man's power wash, which worked surprisingly poorly, and I succeeded in turning a small purple stain into a large, wet pink stain. I finished the sandwich, licked my fingers, stood up, picked the cushion up, flipped it over, and put it back down. I turned to sit, but caught myself. I just stood there staring at the cushion. It was a bit dusty, but for the most part in pristine condition. I shook my head and smiled. Going up the stairs was harder than I expected, and by the time I reached Lacey's room, my newly inflated lung was wheezing, and I was seeing constellations. Once Orion's belt disappeared, I picked up Lacey's pink phone and dialed information. I asked for the number for Adam Gray and Associates, and decided to pay the extra 75 cents for them to dial the number for me. No one answered. I thought about trying Adam Gray, but there would be multiple listings in the Seattle area, and surely the Adam Gray I was seeking had an unlisted number. I searched my brain for the number the nanny had rattled off on my visit. The first 3 numbers I tried were unsuccessful. I swapped a couple numbers around and hit pay dirt. She picked up on the 3rd ring. I asked, "Is this Resmelda?" "This is she. This is Agent Todd Gregory. I hope I didn't get you in any trouble the other day." She made a humph sound, then said, "First, your name is Thomas something or other, and 2, you only got me fired, deported, and sued is all. And I'm never allowed to see the girls again." She started sobbing. I leaned my head back, took a deep breath, and said, "What happened?" After she composed herself, she said, "Mr. Gray came home not long after you left. He burst through the door, screaming. He fired the security guy, Ralph, on the spot. Poor Ralph. His wife is due with twins in January. I told Mr. Gray we only talked for a couple minutes, then you left. But he wouldn't believe me. He thinks you were inside the house. Something about drawers being opened." If I remembered correctly, I'd made a conscious effort to leave everything precisely as I'd found it. I had a feeling maybe Shelley had done some drawer pulling after I'd left, or maybe he'd noticed that his bank statements were suddenly MIA. Either way, it didn't matter. Adam Gray had been suspicious enough that he'd gone to look at the security tapes at the security booth and knew it was me. Hopefully, he didn't have any tapes of me breaking and entering. But if he had, I suspect I would have been arrested, or worse. By the end of Resmelda's narrative, I started to feel partly responsible for her getting fired and deported and sued, but only partly. I said, "I need to talk to Mr. Gray. Haven't you done enough?" The inflection in her voice denoted that I had, in fact, done enough. I said, "I'll get you your job back." She was silent for a moment, then said, "How are you going to do that?" "I can prove Mr. Gray is innocent." "How?" "A couch cushion." "How is a couch cushion going to prove Mr. Gray is innocent?" "You're just going to have to trust me." She was silent. "If you ever want to see your girls again, you're going to have to trust me." "Okay. But I don't know his cell number. It was programmed into the phone they gave me, and he took it back." "Damn." I could try him at his office on Monday, but I had a feeling if I walked through his office doors, I might not walk out. Resmelda interrupted my thoughts. "He'll be at the Ritz-Carlton tonight." "The Ritz-Carlton? Why?" "The office Christmas party. The Daisy Room. I think it starts at 7. I was supposed to attend." She choked up. "I was going to take the girls." I tried to console her, telling her in 11 different ways that everything would turn out just fine. She sniffed. "So you'll get me my girls back? Do peanuts grow on trees?" "No. I thought they did. I don't think so." "Never mind, I'll get your girls back." I could feel her smile on the other end. I looked at the clock above the stove. It was 6:47 p.m. I hung up with Resmelda. I had a party to crash. Chapter 25. The Ritz-Carlton is located in downtown Seattle. As far as hotels go, the Ritz is the top of the line. It doesn't get much swankier. The average room goes for $3, suites for $5, and presidential suites are in the low four figures. Ballrooms are rumored to be reserved years in advance, the main ballroom a decade. I pulled my car into the valet area and stepped out. A kid dressed in a white shirt and black vest opened my door. He looked me up and down and tried to stifle a laugh. I hadn't had much to work with in the wardrobe department, and I was clad in some of my dad's snazzier dinnerware. I was guessing the Adam Gray and Associates Christmas extravaganza would be black tie. I was dressed in one of my father's old tuxedos circa 1985, and I imagine I looked like I had just walked off the set of the last episode of Dynasty. I made my way through the revolving doors and into the mezzanine. A large sign listed each of the four ballrooms. The Rose Room was the Starbucks Christmas party. The Tulip Room was the Oracle Christmas party. The Daisy Room was the Adam Gray and Associates Christmas party. The Daisy Room was located on the 7th floor. I stepped off the elevator and followed arrows until I heard the party. A woman sat at an antique writing table at the entrance. She had a name tag, Tracy. Tracy asked my name and I gave her one. She asked how to spell it and I guessed. She wrinkled her nose and said, "I'm not seeing you here." I told her I was a special guest of Adam's. She scribbled on a name tag and handed it to me. She smirked and said, "Here you go, Percival." She added, "Table 62. "How many tables are there?" "62. "Ah, the leper table. Just my luck. I get stuck with the secretary with the lazy eye and a lawyer with halitosis. Just out of curiosity, how many are you expecting tonight?" She said, including lawyers, paralegals, secretaries, plus guests, they were expecting close to 300. As I entered the ballroom, I noticed half the people were sitting, the other half making small talk or congregating near the bar. Two couples had already made their way to the dance floor, and they slow danced to the smooth styling of Eddie Money. As I guessed, most men were decked out in penguin suits, and the women were clad in recently acquired dresses. If Gray's lawyers were anything like him, most of these wives hadn't had a reason to dress up, well, probably since the last Christmas party. Waiters zoomed in and out of the crowds with trays filled with champagne, wine, and hors d'oeuvres. I surveyed the crowd for any sign of Gray. I didn't see him, but I did spot his receptionist, Sunny. She was wearing a black dress, cut low, showing off her plastic tetons. She was surrounded by no less than 7 different guys. Men are pigs. Needless to say, I headed in that direction. Just kidding. I made my way over to the bar, and the bartender rattled off a bunch of beers. I told him to bring me whatever was the coldest. He brought me a Sam Adams. It tasted a lot like beer, which I like in a beer. The guy next to me struck up a conversation. He asked what year my tuxedo was from. I told him I took his wife to the prom in this tuxedo. He found this hysterical and slapped me on the shoulder. His eyes were already starting to glaze over, and he said, "I've always liked you, Percival." I didn't have the heart to tell him that he met me close to 70 seconds earlier. His name was Max. Max had a story for everything, and whether or not they were true, they kept my attention for 3 more beers. A public service announcement here, if anyone ever starts off a story with the words, "So, I'm at this donkey show," do yourself a favor and rip off your ears. Around 8:30, I spotted Mr. Adam Gray. He had just started making the rounds. He got about halfway through the tables when they started asking people to take their seats for dinner. Max attempted to drag me to his table, which was table 7, only 3 tables from Adam's. I respectfully declined. I didn't want to get thrown out before I got my hands on some chicken cordon bleu. I retired to table 62. There were 3 open seats, and I took one with my back to the center of the room. The secretary with the lazy eye was actually the secretary without a chin. There was no definitive spot where her neck ended and her face began. So you had chinless, then you had stutter, third person Paul, wig lady, manic depressive Asian, hook arm, adult braces, and 80s tuxedo. All in all, the who's who of birth defects, personality disorders, and vagabonds off the street. Go, table 62. We made small talk, and I lied quite a bit. The chicken cordon bleu was excellent. Hook arm didn't want hers and asked if I wanted it. I said yes, and she proceeded to slide her chicken onto my plate using her hook. I did not eat it. Dessert was carrot cake, and I had 2 slices. Adam stood up and gave a toast about the past year, how proud he was of his team, that the year ahead looked even more promising, and for everyone to enjoy themselves. He failed to mention that in the new year he would probably go on trial for his life. Moot point, I guess. After champagne toast, the music started back up. Plates were cleared and people started to mingle. Women huddled around tables, men flocked to the bar, 12 couples headed for the dance floor. I bid farewell to my comrades at table 62, albeit with a strong sense that Chinless and third-person Paul were going to make some poor decisions. I overheard Paul say, "Paul doesn't care about chins." I made my way to Adam's table and sidled up to the group of 6 guys, including my friend Max, that had congregated there. Adam was telling a golfing anecdote, and I worked my way into the inner circle. I was 2 people to Adam's left. Adam was saying, "Sand trap was 30 feet deep. Mickelson bets me 50 large he'll get up and down. I tell him he's on. He reaches into his bag, and I shit you not, he takes out his 7-wood. He takes a half swing. The ball runs up the 30-foot lip, trips over, and ends up 3 inches from the cup. Best golf shot I've ever seen." I leaned in and said, "I once saw this kid hit a ball through a windmill." A couple guys gave a slight chuckle. Max found this hilarious. Adam looked at me directly and smiled. "Enjoying the party, Mr. Prescott?" "I am. Chicken was a bit dry, but I'm sure you didn't cook it." "I'll pass that on to Wolfgang." After an awkward second, he said, "I'm glad you stopped by so I can tell you in person that I drafted up a civil suit for trespassing. I plan to enter it into court tomorrow morning." I could have denied ever being there. I could have concocted a story. I could have done a lot of things. I went with Calvin Klein, huh? He cocked his head to one side. I was surprised. I would have taken you for a Fruit of the Loom guy. He took a deep breath, exhaled. "Please leave before I have you thrown out." No one moved or said anything for a good 3 seconds. I took a long sip of beer. Adam waved over a couple of gentlemen, and they politely asked me to leave. Then they asked me impolitely to leave, which involved my arms being wrenched behind my back. The entire room went quiet. The DJ had even killed the music. As I was being dragged out, I yelled, "I know you didn't kill your wife." A hush fell over the crowd. Adam locked eyes with me, and I said with a smile, "And I can prove it." Chapter 26. The security guards let me go. The only sound was that of Adam storming in my direction. He turned me around and pushed me forward through the double doors and into the hallway. We made our way to the elevators, called for one, and stepped inside. Adam hit the emergency stop button and said, "This better be good." Just to clear the air, if I was to go toe-to-toe with Adam Gray, I wouldn't win. But then again, neither would he. There's a good chance we'd both end up paying for the other's reconstructive surgery. I brushed my tuxedo smooth and said, "I came here as a favor." You call crashing my Christmas party and embarrassing me in front of my employees a favor. I laughed. Adam didn't. I took a deep breath and said, you said the night your car was stolen, you went across the street, getting a drink, and were drugged, beat up, and had your keys stolen. He nodded. Then the next morning, you woke up in your condo. You had no idea how you got there. Right? According to the navigational system on your yacht, it was taken out that night at 11:25 p.m., driven 70 miles out to the middle of the Sound, stopped for exactly 2 minutes, then driven to where it was found in Edmonds at 3:17 a.m. That's what they tell me. According to you, you can't account for your whereabouts from 10 that evening until 9 when you woke up the next morning. Again, correct. So technically, you could have been on your yacht. He took a deep breath, let it out. I could see him visualizing 12 of his peers digesting this information. Finally, he said, quite objectively, technically, yes. Now we're getting somewhere. I smiled. Gray lurched forward and hit the emergency stop button. He said, I think you've wasted enough of my time. I moved in front of him and slapped the button. If you'd give me one more fucking minute, I'm about to give you your life back. He squinted at me as if he might be able to read my mind if he tried hard enough. When I was in your office that day, I noticed a stain on two of your couch cushions. He raised his eyebrows. Stain? That couch is worth 25 large. I think I'd know if it had stains. I'm sure you would. It had been scrubbed, then flipped upside down. I would never do that. I know you wouldn't. That's how I'd put it together. I'd no problem flipping the cushion over, but OCD Adam could never. The stain was blood. Blood? On my couch? He looked queasy just thinking about it. I helped him along. You made it back there that night. What do you mean? I'm guessing you were drugged, probably some sort of tranquilizer. Okay. Here's my theory. October 15. Someone abducts and kills your wife. They dump her body in the ocean, but somewhere they have access to. Maybe they weight her body down in a shallow area or tie her up to a pier. Could be anywhere. I think this nut has it out for you, too. Maybe he wants both Grays tied up to his pier. So come the Sunday before Thanksgiving, he waits for you outside the bar and hits you with some sort of tranquilizer. But you don't go down. You put up a fight and get away, but not before you sustain a couple injuries. Somehow the guy gets your keys. Maybe they slip out of your pocket during the struggle. The guy finds the gun in your glove compartment and has this brilliant idea. Maybe he can't kill you, but he can put you away for life. He retrieves Ellen's body from wherever he has it stashed, takes out your yacht, dumps Ellen's body overboard and plants the gun. As for you, you're drugged up, bloody, moving on instinct alone. You're close to your office building. By some miracle, you make it to the garage, the private elevator, and into your office, then to the couch. Gray went quiet, his brow furrowed. I could tell he was running this through his head, weighing its plausibility. Finally, he said, if this is true, then I would be on the surveillance camera in my office. Right. Which you have done by a third party. They store the images on a hard drive, and if I'm correct, then you can't alter any images. Nope. But I can log into my account and watch the live feed from my office, or I can go into the archives and watch any point in time. I cocked my head. He hit the emergency stop button once more, then hit the button for the 22nd floor. He said, business center. We stepped off the 22nd floor, and Adam slid a card in a conference room door lock. He pulled the door open, and the lights went up. At the head of a large conference table sat a laptop. He flipped the top up, turned it on, and was on the internet in a matter of seconds. After a couple of quick clicks, the image on the computer monitor was superimposed on the projection screen on the wall behind us. I watched as he typed in his security company's website, then his account number and password. The page refreshed, and 9 separate images popped up. His desk, the bookcase, the bar, the aquarium, the filing cabinets, the elevator, the doors, the couch, and the back wall. He clicked on archives and typed in November 19, the night his yacht was taken out and presumably Ellen's body was thrown overboard, then moved numbers around to start at 8 p.m. The page refreshed but looked identical. The plant was smaller. I said fast forward. He hit the double arrows and we watched as the time moved quickly. By 9, nothing had happened. Then 10. Then 11. Then the date moved to the 20th. Adam looked at me. Shit. He shook his head. Happy? He started to flip the laptop closed when I said, wait. He turned and watched the big screen. The clock read 12:11:54 a.m. The light over the elevator had just lit up. I pointed to it. Someone's on the way up. He clicked the play button on the computer screen. We looked at each other, then back to the screen. After about 6 seconds, the elevator doors opened and a body flopped out. It was Adam. We watched the rest of the video. A bloodied and disoriented Adam crawled on his hands and knees to the couch. Nothing else would happen for 7 hours. At exactly 7:12:06 a.m., a head peeked into the office. It was an older woman with white hair. I said, "Who's that?" "June. She cleans the office every Monday morning." The white-haired woman on the screen took another step into Gray's office. Maybe June saw the blood or smelled it. Either way, she made her way to Adam and shook him. When he didn't respond, she became agitated and frazzled. She attempted to flip him over. After a couple tries, she got him on his side. He was covered in blood. She started crying. After composing herself, she dragged him off the couch, laid him on his back on the floor, then walked out of the room. She returned with 2 bottles of cleaning supplies, a sponge, and a couple towels. She began scrubbing the cushions. Adam was fighting down a smile. I couldn't blame him. This wouldn't exonerate him completely, but it would put a large dent in the state's case against him. We fast-forwarded as June scrubbed for 10 minutes, then flipped over the cushions and replaced them on the couch. Adam hit play. June exited, then returned. She attempted to wake Adam for over a minute. He appeared to open his eyes once or twice, even murmur a couple words, but he was still very much under the influence of the drug. In an impressive display of strength, the tiny woman reached under Adam's armpits, and Fireman dragged him into the elevator. Then the two disappeared. I said, "I'm going to take a stab in the dark here and guess that June also cleans your condo." He nodded. "So she would have keys to the condo." "She would." "And I'm guessing she's been with you a long time and is loyal to a fault."
"Correct."
"So June thought he killed his wife, but she kept quiet. I think it was safe to assume June had a substantial Christmas bonus coming her way." Adam stuck out his hand and said, "I don't know how to thank you." I told him he could start by dropping the civil suit and giving Resmelda her job back. He told me to consider it done. He removed a card from his pocket and handed it to me. He patted me on the shoulder and said, "If you ever need anything at all, don't hesitate to call." I stuck the card in my pocket. I wouldn't. Chapter 27. They celebrated Christmas on the 22nd, which I found odd, seeing as how it wasn't Christmas, or Christmas Eve, or even Christmas Eve Eve, for that matter. But they were old, and if they wanted to celebrate Arbor Day in August, then I'd plant my tree in August. Harold had mentioned on my last visit that none of his family was going to make it out for the holiday, and it's not like I had much else to do. I knocked on the door, and Harold answered. He was wearing a red turtleneck and a Santa hat. Sort of like what Santa would look like if he was 86 pounds, had extensive electrolysis, and had died 3 or 4 years earlier. I wasn't exactly sure what one buys for someone who can say the words, "So me and Patton are shooting the shit when Lee comes in," and be completely serious, but I decided on a gift certificate for LASIK. Just kidding. I got him a subscription to Girls Gone Wild. He took the 2 videos from me, looked around his small room for a good minute, then slid them under the couch cushions. Good thinking. Harold told me he had to go to the bathroom and to sit tight. 55 minutes later, he returned with a small gift in his little basket and held it up. It was about the size of a coffee mug and haphazardly wrapped. A large white bow was stuck to a crumpled section of wrapping paper atop. Harold held the gift out and said, "For you." Lacey had bought me tickets for the upcoming Seattle Seahawks playoff game, but the presents she'd sent me wouldn't arrive until after Christmas, so there was a good chance the small package before me, which I was almost certain was a coffee cup, would be the only present I opened for Christmas. I ripped off the wrapping paper and revealed a coffee mug stuffed with 1/2 banana and a tapioca snack pack. I thanked him for his generosity, and the guy waved me off like he'd just bought me a brand new Lexus. We retired to the Christmas celebration, and Harold and I ate at a table with 2 of the CNN aisles and their families. It was a mix of young and old, daughters, sons, nieces, nephews, and even a couple babies. The meal was good. And after they'd cleared our plates, we played reindeer games for over an hour. Then a couple old-timers jumped on the piano, and we sang Christmas carols and danced, or, in the case of 3 couples and mobility scooters, played bumper cars. At around 7, the party fizzled. Apparently, colostomy bags don't empty themselves. But I wasn't ready to leave. I wanted to hear some more of Harold's story. I followed behind Harold on the way back to his building. He stopped, turned, and said, "You know what I really want?" I shook my head. "A Slurpee."
"A Slurpee?"
"Yeah, a Slurpee." So Harold and I went for Slurpees. Harold was buckled in the passenger seat, his walker lying across the hole of the back seat. When we'd first made it to the car, Harold had asked if he could drive. I told him if it was up to me, he could drive the car off a cliff. But according to the 7 documents I had to sign and the urine sample I had to leave with the prune at the front desk, he wasn't allowed to drive. There was a gas station 2 miles up the road, and I stopped, ran in, and grabbed a couple Slurpees. Back in the car, I handed Harold his Mountain Dew Kryptonite Ice Slurpee and said, "Where to?" He took a long slurp and said, "Just drive." So I just drove. After 10 minutes of just driving, Harold had slurped up the majority of a Slurpee, which, after only a couple sips, had given me a nice little hand tremor, heart arrhythmia, a headache, a toothache, and the sensation I was falling. Harold took one final slurp, set the cup between his legs, and said, "She was to meet me at the train station." After 3 years, Harold was finally set to go home. He had traded letters with Elizabeth for the last 9 months. In one of her last letters, Elizabeth had sent him a picture, a black and white that just barely fit in the envelope. It was of her, her 2 brothers, her mom, and her dad. Harold couldn't believe how much she'd grown. She was wearing a white blouse and a long black skirt. Her dark hair was long, disappearing behind her back. Harold didn't know the right word to describe her. Perfect simply didn't do her justice. In the picture, her father had his right hand resting on Elizabeth's shoulder. Harold remembered that right hand, remembered it striking him in the face. But if he could make something as beautiful as Elizabeth, then he couldn't be all bad, could he? Plus, he would soon be Harold's father-in-law. They would be forced to get along. He decided then and there to forgive the man. In April, the day finally came. Harold hadn't slept in 4 days. In her last letter, she had told him she would be waiting at the train station for him, that she couldn't wait to hold him in her arms. She couldn't believe she was actually going to see the man she so deeply loved. After 2 days of traveling, Harold was back at Fort Bragg. He hopped on a train and 3 days later found himself arriving at the same train station he departed from over 3 years earlier. He thought about the young man, boy, really, who had left on that train. A boy was now returning a man, and he had Elizabeth to thank. The train ground to a halt, and Harold pressed his nose against the glass. His train was filled with a handful of soldiers, in a large mob. Fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, grandparents, and girlfriends alike was waiting on the platform. Harold's hands were shaking so badly he was having a hard time holding onto his duffel bag. He stepped off the train, the commotion thundering. She had told Harold she would be wearing her favorite red blouse and a white skirt. Harold walked up and down the small walkway. He scanned the masses, saw a girl in a red blouse. He ran up to the girl, but when she turned, it wasn't Elizabeth. The train emptied, and slowly the throngs of people dissipated. Soon the only person remaining was Harold. Harold, holding onto his bag. Harold, the tears dripping from his eyes. "She never showed?" Staring straight ahead, he said, "She never showed." "But she had a good reason. You went to her house and she gave you a good reason." He looked at me but said nothing. I said, "You went to her house, though, didn't you?" "Oh, I went to her house, all right." Harold began walking in the direction of the King Mansion. There had to be a good reason Elizabeth hadn't shown. Had she simply forgotten? He didn't see how. Harold's stomach lurched. What if she was sick? Or what if it was something worse? It had to be terrible, just awful, if it would keep her from him. He dropped his duffel bag and began sprinting the 7 miles to the King Mansion. He came abreast of the house and slowed. He looked out over the small lake, the turquoise water whipping in the light breeze. That spring morning played over in his head in slow motion. The dog, Elizabeth screaming, the light touch on his arm, the soft whisper. Elizabeth never taking her eyes off him. He ran up the drive to the house. He noticed there wasn't a single car parked in front of the house. No shiny black automobiles. He set his bag down and began banging on the door. He must have banged for an hour. He banged against that door until his hands started to bleed. He tried to tell himself they were at church or on a vacation. These rich people were always taking vacations. But he knew. He knew they were gone. Knew she was gone. Knew he would never see his sweet Elizabeth again. Chapter 28. The kid who delivered my pizza on Christmas was the same kid who delivered my pizza on Thanksgiving. I asked him if this made him a bigger loser than me. He laughed and we decided to call it a tie. I tipped him $100 and told him I'd see him on Easter. Lacey called later that night and we chatted for a couple hours. Her boyfriend, Caleb, one of my past students and an altogether good guy, was visiting and had popped the question. The two hadn't set a wedding date, but they were shooting for spring of the following year. After I hung up with Lacey, I went for a long run. It had been almost 2 weeks since the fish incident, and I was ready to give my lung a try. I did my usual routine of push-ups and sit-ups before setting out into the drizzle. My chest was tight for the first couple miles. Then, like everything else, my lungs seemed to loosen up. As my feet slapped against the wet gravel, I found myself getting introspective, which I normally avoided like the plague. It might have had something to do with my sister's engagement. Here she was, 8 years my junior, and she'd found the one thing she was passionate about, and the one person she wanted to spend the rest of her life with. Then he had me. At the present juncture, I was unemployed. I was up to my ears in a case that I shouldn't be involved in. I was a phone call away from spending a couple months behind bars. I hadn't had sex in 3 months, and yesterday I'd found a gray hair, and not on my head. Something had to give. I woke up early on the 26th. The Seattle Municipal Library was all gray brick. It was still early, around 10, and the lot was half full. I walked into the large building, followed a couple signs, and 30 seconds later, I was sitting in front of a computer. I brought up Google and typed Ellen Gray. There were 500,000 results. I clicked on the third result down, the official website of Governor Ellen Gray. The page came up, but all it said was, Governor Ellen Gray, 1960 to 2010. She will be missed. I clicked back to the results page, scrolled down a couple hits, then clicked on the Wikipedia page for Ellen Gray. Ellen had graduated from the University of Washington with a bachelor's degree in speech and sociology. She had been president of her sorority. She, like her husband, had a law degree, graduating from Gonzaga. From here, she quickly moved up the ranks of the political arena. I scrolled down. Ellen Gray was elected governor 4 years earlier, beating out the incumbent by a mere percentage point. There was a section marked priorities, followed by a bulleted list. Building a safe and effective transportation system. Educating to compete. Taking charge of our health. Reducing our dependence on foreign oil. Caring for our environment. Holding our government accountable. Strengthening families. Supporting Washington farmers and ranchers. There was a small blurb for each. I scrolled down the building a safe and efficient transportation system and began reading. The first legislative session ended with Gray brokering new bipartisan transportation legislation. The package included a 0.5-cent per gallon gas tax increase to help repair many roads in Washington, particularly around Seattle, such as the Alaskan Way Viaduct, Interstate 405, and the Route 520 Bridge. This proposal was initially rejected by the House, but then passed with a revote the final day of the 2008 session. The tax package was met with mixed reviews. While she was praised widely by Democratic and Republican leaders of the House and Senate for her leadership skills regarding the passage of this deal, several legislators disagreed about the merits of the tax. Their reasons included the heavy emphasis on funding Seattle-area projects and the already high price of gas. An initiative to repeal the tax, Measure 912, was part of the November 2009 ballot but was rejected by the voters. It seemed that Ellen alienated more than her fair share of concerned citizens. But would anyone go to the extreme of murder over a half-cent tax hike? I read a couple more blurbs, but nothing jumped out at me. I made my way back to the results page and clicked on images. About 30 images popped up, and I scanned a lot of them. One particular picture caught my eye. It was the same shot shown in Ellen Gray's picture montage on the news. She was speaking to a small crowd of mostly men, outdoorsy types. A couple were holding signs that read, Vote Yes on 217. Half the people were wearing shirts that read, Defenders of Wildlife. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was visible on a brown building in the background of the photo. I Googled U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Washington State and was directed to the Washington Division homepage for the agency. I clicked on Field Office, and a picture of the building from the photograph popped up. It looked bigger without the hordes of people surrounding it. I noted the address, 23 North Cascades Highway. I map-quested the address and surveyed the map. The building was a mile from the entrance to North Cascades National Park, where Ellen had gone missing. I hadn't been to the North Cascades since I was a kid. I decided it was time I went back. Chapter 29. North Cascades National Park is located about two-thirds of the way between Seattle and Canada, the last great divider between the land of the free and those who guard the land for thee, and of course cheap prescription drugs. The park is mystical in its beauty, characterized by steep mountains, snaking rivers, subdued falls, lively brush, brazen wildlife, and cavernous glaciers. However, I had little fondness for the North Cascades. I still had distant memories of being wrestled from bed at the crack of dawn to go hiking and fishing. These, my two least favorite activities, united together in some sort of evil father-son liaison, typically climaxed with me falling into a freezing lake, getting attacked by a porcupine, getting a tick, or getting scarlet fever. I would forever associate the North Cascades with terror. Anyhow, I headed up Route 2 northbound. The traffic was light. It was early, meaning it was before noon. The ubiquitous Seattle drizzle turned into a light snow as I entered the mountains. The rains that had plagued Seattle for the last 30 days and 30 nights had come in the form of snow in the elevated areas of the state, and the mountains were covered in a thick blanket of white. I followed the signs, made some treacherous curves, went through two tunnels, and half an hour later, I was parking in a narrow lot piled high with brown snow. In the far west corner of the lot were two Jeep Cherokees. One was simply a Jeep-shaped cloud of snow. The other had a light dusting of flakes and U.S. Fish and Wildlife embossed on the side. As for the building, it resembled something of a leasing office, inviting yet dismissive. It was brown brick and brown aluminum siding. Two windows, set evenly apart, were both of frozen blue and filled to half capacity with snow. As for the roof, the snow was packed high, patiently awaiting a gunshot, a car backfire, or even the slightest vibration to prompt an avalanche. Huge icicles hung from the eaves like clear stalactites. I hopped out and trudged to the entrance. For the record, I looked rather foolish. Because I had failed to pack any winter items when leaving Maine, I was once again relegated to wearing some of my father's old gear. He, like many a Seattleite, was a diehard Seahawks fan, so I was wearing a puffy Seahawks coat, Seahawks beanie, and Seahawks gloves. Thomas Prescott, Seahawks superfan. As I neared the building, I noticed two snowmobiles sleeping, one two-seater and another more compact model. I headed up the angled walkway and rapped on the thin door. No response. I knocked a second time, and the door swung inward, revealing drab orange, industrial carpet. A rush of warm air washed over me. I squeezed my head through the opening and yelled the customary, "Hello? Anybody home?" The prelude for any good breaking and entering. I waited for a response, received none, then pushed the door open and entered into a wide room. To my immediate left were two doors. One, I guessed, led to an office and the other to a lavatory. Soft light shone through the windows. I hit a light switch and surveyed my surroundings. There were a series of displays set up within the room, and posters and maps covered most of the walls. I moved to one of the displays. It was a plaster slab of a fish. I read about it. This particular fish was best known for its ability to swim as well as breathe underwater. I spent the next few minutes reading about the various types of wildlife that roamed the North Cascades. Mountain lions, mountain goats, black bears, grizzly bears, lynx, moose, wolverines, cougars, elk, deer, beavers, raccoon, bats, you name it. According to a large topographical map, North Cascades National Park covered more than 685,000 acres. The majority of the mountain peaks were under 10,000 feet, save for one, Mount Baker, standing tall at 10,778. I made my way to the hall and pushed the first of two identical doors inward. It revealed a functional bathroom, a single toilet with no lid and rusty pipes. A soon-to-be-retired roll of toilet paper sat atop the tank. A solitary light dangled from the ceiling. It swayed in a tight circle from an unknown source. I pulled the door closed and moved on. The second door led to a compact office with a small desk at center. Sitting atop a clutter of paper was an open Tupperware container, the fork and knife resting peacefully on the bottom, the lid askew. Directly behind the desk was a black filing cabinet with two of its four drawers pulled out at different distances. A pair of skis crisscrossed in one corner and a rifle catnapped in another. The walls were covered with maps, notices, memos, things tacked to the wall. A deep rock water system gurgled just feet from me. It was filled with light blue pebbles and green vegetation. I leaned down for closer inspection and noticed two fish floating at the surface. I visualized Adam Gray standing in the doorway, his thumb in his mouth rocking lightly back and forth. I glanced at a couple different documents strewn on the desk, mostly gibberish, stuff starting with Section 7, Code 12, Clause BB, and ending with a long list of contributors. No thanks. I went for the filing cabinet. It was alphabetized. A through F in the top bin, G through L in the second, and so on. The second drawer from the bottom was opened. I fingered the manila folders, pulled out P, opened it, thumbed through a folder marked Precipitation Records. Lots of line graphs. I replaced the folder. Over the next few minutes, I checked W for why Ellen Gray was killed. No go. I searched S for secret and T for top secret. No and no. I searched M for murder, which did contain a Sue Grafton novel, but little else. I was searching E for election when I stumbled on a folder marked Endangered. It was a bright red folder, the only red folder I'd yet to encounter. I flipped through a couple pages, lots of small print. The fifth page was orange and had Ballot Measure 217 written atop. I recalled the photograph of Ellen behind a podium, the man in the audience with the Defenders of Wildlife t-shirt holding a sign that read Vote Yes on Measure 217. The top sentence read, Ballot Measure 217 is a repeal of Bill SE-1670, thereby granting the reintroduction of the Canis lupus to the North Cascades National Park. So Ellen Gray was an animal rights activist. Another dead end. Ahem. I looked up. A woman stood in the doorway. She had a tan jacket with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife logo on the left breast and a black headband with the same logo. She had short brown hair and blue eyes. She reminded me of the cute girl from Northern Exposure, Maggie O'Connell. Most importantly, she looked substantially annoyed. She scowled at me, then said, Did you eat that? I raised my eyebrows. She pointed to the Tupperware container. My lunch. Did you eat my lunch? That would be a no. It was sitting out like that when I broke in and started snooping. She shook her head. I swear, if that bastard eats my lunch one more time, I'm gonna cut off his balls. Who? Other guy doing rounds today, Herb. She stared at me for an awkward moment. What are you doing in my office? It's always best to tell the truth in a situation such as this, and I said, I'll level with you. I'm a bounty hunter. You don't look like a bounty hunter. I looked myself up and down. No, I sure didn't. I looked like a crazed Seahawks fan that had just broken out of an institution. But I was already committed to the lie, and so began the stupidest story in the history of time. 7 minutes later, when I concluded my ridiculous tall tale, the bewildered park ranger said, And you think after he jumped out of the plane he landed somewhere around here? I nodded. Well, I hope you find him. Me too. I can take you around in the snowmobile if you want. It's not like I had anything else to do. And I wasn't about to turn down a snowmobile ride with the increasingly cute park ranger. That would be great. As we were heading for the door, I said, Just out of curiosity, what are Canis lupus? She turned. Canis lupus? Yeah. She paused, then smiled. Wolves. Chapter 30. I mentally gulped and said, Did you say wolves? In fourth grade, I was on a field trip to the zoo, and let's just say there was an incident involving a 7-year-old Thomas Prescott and the wolf exhibit. I vaguely remember a teacher screaming, Thomas, how did you get in there? I believe I responded, I want to pet the doggies. Long story short, I ended up on television, the zoo was closed indefinitely, my teacher was fired, I got 17 stitches, a wolf was put down, and I wet my bed every other night until I was 12. She nodded, Yep, wolves. I thought back to all the wildlife exhibits in the adjoining room. There had been no mention of wolves. I asked, why wolves? There used to be lots of wolves in the North Cascades, but over the course of the last 60 years, they have slowly been eradicated. No thanks to me. She added, they're an important part of the ecosystem. I didn't think they were still endangered. Well, in Canada and other parts of the Americas, they're thriving. There are more than 50,000 wolves up in Canada, and they have made a comeback in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Idaho. And most recently, they were reintroduced to Yellowstone National Park. But here in Washington, and a couple other states where they used to roam free, wolf populations are nearly depleted. I nodded along. Wolves became nearly extinct in the lower 48 states in the early part of the 20th century because settlers believed wolves caused widespread livestock losses. They were constantly targeted by large-scale predator eradication programs sponsored by the federal government. By the time wolves were finally protected by the Endangered Species Act of 1973, they'd been exterminated from the lower 48 states. I did not know that. She nodded along to herself and said, wolves, more than any other species, can be credited with keeping the other hunters in check. They are what we call a super predator, which means they eat other predators. They keep the deer population down, elk, caribou. There are countless other animals that rely on wolves to eat, birds, small rodents, and other carnivores that aren't capable of kills on their own. Why do people have to vote for whether or not they can be reintroduced to the area? Wolves are and always will be an extremely controversial animal. There's an old saying, wolves can live with people. People can't always live with wolves. She's preaching to the choir on this one. She continued, wolves have always had a mystique about them. Think about it. Little Red Riding Hood, the boy who cried wolf, even the three little pigs. It's more myth than anything else, but it's ingrained in each of us at such a young age that it's hard to separate the animal from the lore. You missed the part about the werewolf. She smiled. That one started in Europe. They believe the devil was personified in the form of a werewolf, half man, half wolf. These terrifying creatures were supposed to live in the forests and to feast on human flesh at night. Can we talk about Ebola? She laughed. She had a big dimple in her right cheek. It isn't all bad. Wolves are revered by many cultures. In Native American mythology, the gray wolf represents the figure of the master and sage. Its teeth are a talisman, ensuring courage and liberty. There is a dual aspect to the symbolic value of the wolf. On one hand, it is dark and terrifying. On the other hand, benevolent and life-saving. In some cultures, it accompanies souls to the hereafter. Hades, the Greek god of the underworld, wore a wolf skin. And Etruzan, the god of death, had the ears of a wolf. I nodded like I'd known Etruzan personally. She asked, are you familiar with Etruzan? I follow him on Twitter. She laughed again, and I switched the subject before she got going about the Aztecs. I said, so tell me about Ballot Measure 217. After they reintroduced the wolves to Yellowstone and parts of Idaho, there were some ramifications on the surrounding communities. In the following years, a few states passed bills that would prohibit the introduction of the gray wolf. Washington was one of those states. A bill was passed in 2006. Defenders of Wildlife and other such organizations have been fighting to have it repealed each of the last 3 years. So the repeal passed? In November, third try. Ellen Gray must have felt strongly on the issue to get it on the ballot on 3 separate occasions. I took a step forward and said, I didn't catch your name? Riley. Riley Peterson. I introduced myself. Then I added, I'm not really a bounty hunter. Yeah, I sort of figured as much. I smiled meekly. Riley said, I'm about to go feed them if you want to tag along. Feed who? The wolves. Well, that depended entirely on if she wanted to watch a 33-year-old man piss himself. But I was just the least bit curious to know if I'd conquered this little phobia of mine. Plus, Park Ranger Riley made me tingle. Well, not me. It. I said, why not? She walked past me to a wooden cabinet and opened one of the doors. She slipped a couple things in her pocket, then turned around. She had 2 power bars in her hand and said, want one? Sure. She handed me a bar, which was banana, and asked, so do you, like, play for the Seahawks or something? I followed behind Riley until we reached the snowmobiles. Another snowmobile was parked near the other two now, only facing the opposite direction. A faded bumper sticker on the front read, I love Chachi. I'd only known Riley for going on 11 minutes, but I still found this fitting. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to ride shotgun or if I was expected to drive one of the other sleds, as Riley referred to them. Riley took it upon herself to clear up this matter. She turned and said, "Are you just going to stand there or are you going to hop on?" I hopped on. The fit was tight. There wasn't anywhere to put my hands, so I folded them in my lap. Riley tilted her head up and said, "Better hold on." I shrugged and wrapped my arms around her midsection. She was just a tiny little thing underneath the large jacket. Riley turned around and said dryly, "I meant to hold on to the handholds." Whoops. I undid my hands and looked down at the thin bar jutting from both sides of the snowmobile. I took hold of both and said, "Sorry." She turned her head around and said, "Don't be." Then she gave me a soft wink. Riley hit a red button. The engine coughed, caught, then purred. She gunned the throttle and the snowmobile shot forward, slicing through the open area behind the building, crisscrossed in fresh tracks and day-old tracks, nearly wiped clean by Mother Nature. Riley followed an invisible path, zipping around trees, plowing through valleys, skirting around boulders. Over the course of the next 15 minutes, I would learn a substantial amount of information about Park Ranger Riley Peterson. For one, she wasn't a park ranger at all. She had her master's degree in biology. She had thought about becoming a vet but didn't think she would thrive in an office building. And two, she was a diehard Seahawks fan. She rambled on about their season, who was playing well, who was dogging it, why the front office was a bunch of morons, why they should have just kicked a field goal, while Hasselbeck should get hair plugs, and so on and so forth. We came within a stone's throw of a raging river and stopped. Riley hopped off the snowmobile and said, "I'll just be a second." She started trudging through the snow. She came back 2 minutes later with two vials filled with river water. She said, "We check the pH a couple times a week." I nodded, then asked, "What's the name of that river?" "The Smohomish. It starts up in Canada, runs for about 90 miles, and eventually empties into the Sound." I found this interesting, but I wasn't sure why. She continued on for another couple minutes about the different species of fish and other animal life that inhabited the river. I felt like I was on a field trip and I would have to fill out a handout when we finished. We picked our way through a dense portion of trees, then popped out into vast whiteness, literally a lake of snow. The only thing breaking the horizon was tall metal fencing girdling the perimeter. The fencing was about 8 feet high, with the top couple feet curving inward, resembling something of a lowercase F. Within this haven, sitting at the far back right corner, was a small brick building. Riley brought the snowmobile to a halt and said over the engine, "This is the den." Impressive. "And exactly how big is the den?" "Well, it isn't actually a den. That's just a stupid name Herb came up with. The fencing extends into those trees down there and down the slope, about 7 acres. We want the wolves to have as realistic an experience as possible before we release them into the wild. It increases their chances for survival dramatically." "When did the project start?"
"December 1st. We're doing a soft release with this pack, mainly because there are pups involved. We plan to release them into the park the second week of January."
She explained that a hard release was when you simply took the wolves and literally dumped them in a new area. A soft release let the animals acclimate to the new climate in an enclosure, usually between 1 and 3 acres. Theirs was larger than normal, with a full release several weeks later. "Who's in charge of the project?"
"Well, once the red tape was cleared, it was basically me, Herb, and the professor. Herb and I are in charge of the feeding and the tracking. The professor pretty much does everything else."
"Who is the professor?"
"Professor Kobel, guy in charge of the project. Half these wolves he had a hand in rescuing. He's different."
I nodded. She decided to elaborate.
"These wolves are his life. He used to be a professor, but he quit and tracked wolves for 15 years. I don't think he ever felt accepted by humanity. But the wolves, I think he felt like they never judged him. You should see him interact with them. It's like he's one of them. It's incredible, really. I don't know what he would have done if the repeal hadn't passed this year."
"Well, he had Ellen Gray to thank for that. I hope he sent her a thank you card." Riley lifted up in the seat. She released the throttle with the right glove and leveled it against the horizon. She lifted her chin with a smile and said, "There they are." I followed her gaze. There were 11 in all. A couple were snow white, 2 were black, and the rest were a different shade of gray. The sight of them sent shivers down my spine. Riley slowly eased the throttle and we started forward. The wolves were positioned on a ridge 1/4 mile into the enclosure,
and all 11 heads snapped in our direction. 22 eyes watched our every move, just studying, watching, scouting, strategizing, planning to kill me. Riley parked the snowmobile outside a gated entrance, and we hopped off. I looked back over my shoulder to the wolves, but there was no trace of them. They'd vanished. Riley unchained the fence and pulled a large gate aside. She drove the snowmobile through the opening and to the small brick building. I asked, "What is this place?" "It's the barn." "The barn?" "This used to be a bunker of sorts for soldiers during the war. A refuge, really. They traversed these mountains on cross-country skis way back when. The place hadn't been used for years. We converted it into a holding stall for the project."
"A holding stall? For what, the wolves?"
"Not exactly."
We entered the building, a musty draft washing over us. The smell was strong, similar to what a petting zoo might smell like. A small outer room was filled with equipment. I guessed it was used to track the wolves. Riley confirmed this. Two sets of cross-country skis leaned against the wall. Riley noticed me eyeing them and said, "Sometimes it's easier to get around on the skis than a snowmobile. The trees are pretty thick in this area." I nodded. A gun was lying in one of the small counters. I picked it up. Riley nodded at the gun. "That's a tranquilizer gun. Darts are filled with ketamine, low-level animal tranquilizer."
"Are these hard to get?"
"In the state of Washington, you need to have a license, but according to Herb, they're readily available on the internet."
"Isn't everything?"
We pushed through a second door to the sound of clattering hooves. There wasn't much for light, but you could hear the deep inhale and exhale of wildlife. Stalls were lined up on both sides of a dirty walkway, and I guessed half of them were occupied. I looked at Riley and asked, "What are they?" Her lips flexed into a thin smirk. "Deer."
Chapter 31. My eyes had started to adjust to the soft light, and I peered over the top of one of the stalls. A deer huddled in the corner. He looked like a Dave. Dave the deer. Dave's eyes bulged and his ears sat back like two perfect isosceles triangles. Riley walked to the far end of the building and propped a door open. The bright light fed into the small room. She moved on down the row, stopping at the last stall on the left. Then she pulled open the stall door and stood back. The deer didn't take much prodding. After about 3 seconds, it shot from the stall and into the sunlight. Riley said, "Feeding time." She pulled the door closed and said, "Let's go watch." We went out the way we'd entered, hopped on the snowmobile, and followed the deer tracks leading from the building's far end into the trees. Riley parked the snowmobile at the tree line and said, "It won't be long now." She shut off the engine, and we were left in simple silence. "Aren't we going to follow the tracks?" I found it odd that I was genuinely intrigued to watch this poor deer be slaughtered. She shook her head. "The deer is the advantage in the trees. The wolves will chase it out into the open." I nodded. She was right. It didn't take long. From deep within the trees came a soft rumbling and a sheet of snow fell from a large spruce. Emerging through the white was the deer. It was about a football field away, but I could see a look of panic on its face, like John Elway scrambling out of the pocket. The wolves bounded behind the prancing deer, teeth gritted, kicking up snow like exhaust fumes. The deer shot out of the tree line about 40 feet ahead of us. The wolves came 3 seconds later, four in a tight group, then a group of five, then a couple stragglers. The two of us swiveled in our seats. The wolves made up the ground quickly in the open, as Riley had predicted. The lead wolf was stride on stride with the deer, cutting off his path to the right. The deer started to its left where, unbeknownst to him, another wolf had materialized. The wolf tangled up one of the deer's legs, and the deer lost a step. That's when the third wolf made its lunge. It latched onto the deer's neck, where it hung for a split second. Then the deer went down, and it was over. Dinner for 11. I felt my head shaking from side to side. It was one of the more amazing feats I'd ever witnessed, equal to, if not greater than, watching Bob Ross paint some trees. Riley started the snowmobile, and we slowly crept toward the feasting wolves until we were less than 15 yards away. A couple of the wolves traded glances our way, but for the most part, their attention was on the deer. Riley said, "We really shouldn't be doing this. The
The less human contact, the better, but you probably won't get another chance to see wolves this close in your lifetime. Promise. She laughed and slapped my leg. I asked, how long have these wolves been here? On closer inspection, only 5 wolves looked full-grown, the other 6 markedly smaller. Well, the 2 big white wolves are an alpha pair from up in Wisconsin. Initially, we were going to wait for the pair to mate and have a litter, but it just so happened 3 weeks after we transported them here, the professor rescued a wolf in Canada that birthed the litter. But the mother died during the pregnancy. 6 cubs, then 3 transports. And you just throw them all together?
Basically. The alpha pair didn't seem to mind.